Today's Teisho is on Case 87 in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 87 is entitled, Wumon's Medicine and Sickness Cure Each Other. Engo's Introduction. The clear-eyed person knows no restriction. At one time, he stands on the top of the mountain with the weeds thick around him. At another time, he is in the bustle of the marketplace, enjoying perfect ease of mind. When he displays the wrath of Nada, he is three-faced and six-armed. When he shows the mercy of the sun-faced and moon-faced, he gives forth the all-embracing light of blessing. In every pinnacle, he reveals all the bodies of the Buddha. Mixing with people, he trudges through the mire. When he performs a transcendent action, even the Buddhas cannot follow him, and they are driven back thousands of miles. Is there anyone among you who can go with him and act with him? See the following. Main subject. Wumon said to his disciples, medicine and sickness cure each other. All the earth is medicine. Where do you find yourself? Secho's verse. All the earth is medicine. Ancient and modern, men make a great mistake. Shut the gate, but do not build the cart. The universe is the highway, vast and wide. Mistaken, all mistaken. Though their noses are stuck up to heaven, they will still be pierced for a rope. Gary has laid out the Zendo in a different configuration. It's a little bit disorienting. You've gotten used to sitting in one place, and now you're sitting perhaps in another place. We have between 6 and 8 people coming tonight. So the idea is that we need to sort of reconfigure the Zendo for their arrival. I think Gary has wanted to put people who are more experienced at each end of the row, which I think is a good idea. So there'll be somebody who's like an anchor at each end, sitting deeply, and then in the middle there'll be people who might have less experience. And but I hope right now, if you're one of the anchor people, you're not feeling sitting there all by yourself in isolation at the end of a long row of empty cushions. So soon they will be filled. That will be nice. People coming for the weekend to have a little taste of Zazen. Some people have busy schedules and can't be here for the full 5 days or 7 days, but want to practice all the same. And some people are coming to try it out, and we'll see how it goes. I'm very happy they're coming, for 2 days, or I'm happy everybody's here, whether for 2 days or 5 days or 7 days. I do think, though, that doing 5 days is well worth it if you can, because probably you've noticed that by around day three, there is a turning. You know, there is a turning. Generally speaking, around day one, people start to get tired. Around day two, they reach the limits of their normal abilities. And then on the third day, people begin to change. They begin to encounter be able to tap into a kind of energy which is quite remarkable. And this may take a little longer than 3 days. In some cases, it might be day four before it happens. Sometimes it happens a little earlier than day three. But there's usually this turning about somewhere around day three. And it's as though, day two is typically the day early morning of day three is typically the day when people leave, if they leave the session early. they allow the perspective of the second day to color their perception. And that's a problem that I don't know how to solve, you know. Because over the years, many people have left Sesshin around the beginning of the morning of day three. It's just like many of you have seen Gary sitting here across from me like a rock. And, you know, we have our morning sit, and he sits without moving. And then the next sit, he sits without moving. The next sit, he sits without moving. And then he gets up, you know. And it's easy, if you're a beginner, to think that he's probably always sat that way. But actually, when Gary first started sitting, he was one of the people who would leave the sesshin early. He would just generally go about day three, early morning. And Gary knows that I love him, so I'm not criticizing him at all. In fact, he's a deep practitioner of Zen, and it's an honor to practice with him. I'm really talking about this so people won't be discouraged or daunted on the morning of the third day. But Gary actually left many sesshin, you know. For about the first couple of years, it would be like he'd come to sesshin. Day two, he'd come into the Dokusan room. How's it going? Good, good. Day three, gone. And I would try to get him to stay. I would go, you know, and when Gary would look at me, it was with a haunted look. It was like ghosts were pursuing him. And it was like nothing I could say was going to induce him to stay, you know. It was like the abject terror. The look of terror, you know. And this has happened many times. The people will come to sesshin. You know, around day two, things are really starting to fall apart, and, you know, they'll leave with, like, this look of, like, abject terror, you know. Sometimes they're mad, too. You know, they get mad at me, too. Many years ago, there was a woman who, believe it or not, was a therapist, and she came to a couple sesshin, and finally, we had a sesshin here in August, and it was our August sesshins have been pretty easy lately, but that particular August was quite hot. It was like 100 degrees, and we were all sitting in here sweating away, you know, because, you know, basically, Zen people don't use air conditioners. You know, that would just be, the ancestors would never forgive me for using air conditioners. So we're sitting with the world as it is, in the heat, you know. She came into Dokusan, and I'm not supposed to talk about Dokusan, but this is not relevant to her personal life. She said, is it okay if we use the pool? And I said, actually, the pool is really not part of Zen tradition, you know. And I wasn't being snide or anything. I just meant it just doesn't seem appropriate for us to all hit the pool, in a sesshin. So she left, and she was furious at me. She was absolutely furious because I wouldn't let her use the pool. And basically she let me know, you know, what she thought of me. And I said, you know, well, if you don't want to be here, it's okay. You know, you don't have to stay. And, you know, after I said that, it was, I can't remember what time of the day it was, but we had a sit coming up. I think it was at around 9 o'clock at night. We had just finished the two sits that started at 8. And she had come to see me, and I said, well, look, if you're very unhappy, you know, you don't have to stay. And I thought maybe she would, you know, think it over and basically, get up the next day after breakfast and leave. But basically, I came in here after going to the, we had a bathroom break, we had tea, we had a bathroom break. I came in and sat down, and I saw her, I heard her car going out the driveway on the gravel, and it was like, it was like the gravel was flying into the air. You know, she was driving so fast. You know, it was just like, so I heard her car zooming off. You know. People get a little bit spooked around, can get a little bit spooked around day two. And I see their faces, and nothing I say. I'll say, look, you know, give it, you know, hang out for another day, you know. And they look at me like, you know, I'm trying to sell them cocaine or something like that, or heroin. You know, it's like, really, I mean, they look at me like you're a bad man. You know, what are you trying to do? You're trying to hurt me. You know, and I was like, come on, stick it out. You know, it'll all get better. You know, and it just never works. I'm working on just going, okay, I understand. You know, good luck. I hope you come back. You know, there's a part of me that wants to try to talk them into it, and it never works, right? So, it's interesting that this happens, you know, that around day two, this can happen to people. And some of it is caused by simple fatigue, right? I mean, we're meditating for 9 hours a day, you know, basically. And we're getting up at 4:30 in the morning, and it's a nonstop schedule, right? There's no downtime. Except when you can sleep, you know, at the end of the work periods. So it's very rigorous, you know. And by day two, people are pretty tired. Your legs are hurting, and you're tired. And basically, you know, a part of it is fatigue, you know. But there's something else going on there, you know, that's very, very important. If it were just fatigue, people's faces wouldn't be white with terror, right? You know, when people leave, they really look like they're being chased by ghosts, because in a way they are, you know. In a way they are being chased by ghosts. I don't mean that there are ghosts, by the way. But people have ghosts. I mean, ghosts, the whole tradition of ghosts, right? The whole concept of ghosts goes back to, it really is reflecting people, the unconscious forces that people carry around inside of them, you know. So, you know, the idea that the dead are among us or something like that, this is really about the unacknowledged people of our lives are still haunting us, maybe, or something like that, you know. So basically, people can be haunted by ghosts. And, one way to think about Sesshin is that, you know, we're going to come to Sesshin, we're going to do Zazen, and we're going to experience bliss, you know. And indeed, many, many people think about sort of quote-unquote spirituality that way. You know, many people think about spirituality as like the path of bliss, right? Let's face it, this is really about living a more joyous life, a more full life, a more alive life, you know. So yes, you know, happiness, the Dalai Lama goes around saying all the time, I think the most important thing is happiness. And some people probably think that's really trivial. You know, happiness is trivial, but it's like, well, what are we doing on Earth, we humans, if we're not trying to at least be happy, you know? I think being happy is a great achievement, and it's very important. I don't think there's anything more important, you know? I mean, my feeling is that all the things humans do, you know, government, creating governments, having technology, science, all these things should be making our lives better, right? Should be making us happier, you know. So I think happiness is a worthy goal. So I'm not putting it down at all. You know, I think the goal of Zen is a happier life. But you know, to get there, you have to go through a process that's difficult, and you have to go through it not once but probably again and again. You know, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news. You know, usually when you see the Dalai Lama's picture, he's smiling, and he's such a lovable guy. You know, I myself love the Dalai Lama. Whenever I read something in the newspaper about him, it makes me happy. When I think of him in Dharamsala meditating, I feel tremendously happy. I feel like the world is a good place to be. And when you see pictures of like various teachers in various traditions, they're usually smiling, you know, or laughing. So there's this powerful attractiveness to happiness, which is a saving grace, right? That humans fortunately want to be happy. You know, that's really nature's way, and it's a good thing to want to be happy. But human beings are complicated. There's no question about it. You know, if you ever hear somebody say, "I'm just a simple person," look out, right? Look out. Because that person has left a lot of doors in himself or herself unopened. You know, "I'm just a simple guy." It's like, no, you're not. You're not a simple guy. "I'm just a simple guy." You're not. You're not. That's not a human being, right? Simplicity is possible for humans, but it takes a great deal of truth-telling and working through to be a simple being, right? So when somebody says that to you, you know, I'm just a simple gal. It's like, no. People are not simple. People are like a labyrinth. You know, You know what a labyrinth is? It's like a maze. In ancient Greece, there was a story about a magician who created this labyrinth. And basically, I'm a little rusty on my mythology this morning, but basically a hero had to rescue a maiden and basically had to go into the labyrinth and do battle with a half-beast, half a monster who was half-human and half-bull, basically, the Minotaur. And so this is a little story about basically, the human mind, really, you know. So humans are not simple. They're complicated, and they get complicated because things happen to humans that cause them suffering and pain. And basically, the way we deal with our injuries is that we close a door on them so that we can function. So if something happens to us in life, it doesn't have to be a major trauma. But even small things, you know, you learn how to contain the damage by sealing it up, you know, sealing it up. And this allows us to function in a certain way, you know. So you know, basically humans create a labyrinth of closed doors. This is to protect ourselves, but you know, we become sort of like lost in the maze. You know, sometimes we don't know what we want, we don't know who we are, we don't even know what happiness would look like. You know, I mean, that's very common. You know, people. They'll do what other people seem to be enjoying, but they might not enjoy it themselves, and they may not even be sure about whether they should enjoy it, whether they deserve to. You know, very human. So people are not really simple. Simplicity is something you have to work at, and the way you become simple is by practicing something like Zazen. It doesn't have to be Zazen. But when we come to Sesshin, we don't just sit down on the cushion and experience bliss. That would be possible for a simple being, but not for a complicated being like a human. When we sit down on the cushion with the intention of experiencing bliss, we may have moments of real samadhi and bliss, but it's likely that sooner or later we are going to encounter something like our shadow self, the shadow self, you know. There's like a self that is our like functioning daytime self, you know, our functioning public self, you know. And that's not a phony part of ourselves. That's real. That's a real part of ourselves. So, you know, basically, I have a friend of mine who is, most people would say he's a very jolly fellow, very funny guy. And sometimes I'll come into the building where I work, and you can actually hear his laughter ringing down the hallway, you know. And it's not phony. He has a very human desire for happiness and for joy, right? And I once saw him coming down the hallway with two of his friends, and he had an arm over each of their shoulders, and he was laughing. And I thought to myself, that's a happy man, right? You know, I mean, he's a male, and both of his friends were women. So, you know, it was complicated. As I say, humans are complicated, right? You know, neither one of those women was his wife, right? So complicated, right? He's walking down the hallway. He's got these two women on an arm. You know, he has a babe on each arm, as we would say. And he's laughing because he's just happy. He's getting all this attention from these two people. And there was a lot of real love, right? There was a lot of real love in that moment. And his laughter, I thought, was really genuine, right? Sometimes his laughter isn't genuine, right? It's forced because he's trying to get to that place where he's spontaneously happy. But it's not really possible for him because the shadow is drawing closer, you know. And then there are moments where he's the shadow has overwhelmed him, you know. And you know, he himself had quite a tragedy as a child. His father tried to commit suicide. And he was that was a great pain, injury for him. That was a real injury, right? You know, we want our fathers to be strong and confident. We want them to model competence for us. We want them to be loving and patient. We don't want to see them destroy themselves in a pool of blood, right? And many things are shaken when that kind of an event happens. This happened to my friend. And so he has tried to live with this all his life, you know, has tried really not to deal with it, not to open that door, you know, that door. And he, like all human beings, craves happiness and wants to be at ease and at peace in the world with people who love him and whom he loves. And by the way, his basic nature is really loving and kind. He's really a lovely person sometimes. But when he feels threatened, he becomes very vindictive and angry. And he terrifies people. He actually terrifies people. A person who worked under his authority told me once that sometimes he would feel like he was going to throw up. He would be so tense. So my friend has this wonderful, kindly, compassionate side, but he also has this other side that's very frightening, very scary, and vindictive. You know, very vindictive. And so these two things are tied up in the same person. You know, what we want to say is somebody's a good person or a bad person. We want to say he's good, he's bad. You know, but this is very unrealistic. You know. Actually, my friend has this wonderful, he can be charming, generous, kindly, or demonic, you know, and it's all tied up in the same person. Maybe this is an extreme case because his life was such a traumatic thing to happen, you know. But it's it seems to me very typical, very human, you know. These kinds of things happen to people typically, you know. It is possible that there is a person somewhere who has no shadow, who's just absolutely untroubled. All the doors are open, but I have never met such a person. And I'm not sure a person like that would be much fun to be around, because the person might not be very, have much insight or wisdom. Generally speaking, I think people have a shadow. All, you know, we meet people whom we envy deeply because they seem to have no shadow sometimes. You know, they seem so at ease in the world, but I would say probably they've worked through many of their obstacles, or they're just very good pretenders. So my feeling is that we have all had injuries that create a kind of shadow side to ourselves. And it doesn't have to be finding our father's, bleeding on the floor. It can be much more modest kind of event, but it could still leave a shadow, you know. So, you know, the shadow takes different forms for different people, you know. So some people have like withering self-criticism, you know. It's just like withering self-criticism, you know. On the surface, you know, it might seem. I suspect my friend, you know, has some element of this, you know, where, you know, somebody might seem very easygoing, very relaxed, but when they're tired, when they're under siege, when they're stressed, you know, all of a sudden there's this other part, you know, and I'm sure you see this in your. Or eventually, if you practice long enough, you'll see this in yourself, that there might be a shadow side. Right, that you know, it might be just scathingly negative. Right, it's just like, you know, you're no damn good. You know, you'll never accomplish anything. You know, we have this voice in our head sometime, right? Or you're an unlovable person. You're basically unlovable. You'll never be loved. You know, you're unworthy of love. You'll live and die alone. You know, these are voices. These are part of our shadow personality, right? Everybody has it. You know, everybody has it in some form, more or less. And so, you know, we might envy those who have no shadow, but really, it's probably a fantasy on our part. It's probably the case that everybody you know has a shadow. I was reading something the other day. It was about therapists, the article said, basically, it said, in order to be an effective therapist, the therapist has, generally speaking, to be less neurotic than the patient. I thought that was great. You know, because that's actually very truthful. You know, that's really like telling the truth. I thought, wow, this is so honest, right? You know, the therapist just has to be slightly less neurotic than the patient. That's just perfect, right? I just thought, exactly, you know. So the idea that there's a therapist somewhere who has no neuroses, right? You know, has no shadow, is a fantasy, right? You know, basically. So even the therapist, it's like even the doctor needs medicine, right? Even the therapist has a shadow, right? And probably a good therapist is quite aware of her shadow, or quite aware of his shadow, and has done a lot of shadow work, you know. So our desire to be healthy can make us stupid, really, right? It can make us unaware. You know, Zen is all about awareness. It's about being aware. The Buddha is all about awareness. His basic idea was that if we're more aware, we will eventually be happier. That's what Buddhism is all about. So Buddhism is not really, and this is not a criticism, but Buddhism is not really a religion of faith. It's a religion of, if you want to call it a religion, it's about awareness. And it basically says, let's inspect reality really thoroughly, and if we do that, we will be happier. You know, that's basically Buddhism. So there's a lot of faith in investigating. And Zen is like, really like Buddhism, on steroids in a way. You know, it's really like hyper-Buddhism, because it's really about this idea that we should investigate reality fearlessly, and that this will actually make us happier, make us healthier. You know, so basically, you know, the assumption is knowing more is better than not knowing. You know, and so, you know, the point is, when you come to Sesshin and you want to be in bliss, that's a noble aspiration. All humans want to be happy. You know, in traditional Buddhism, you end all the sutras by saying, "May all beings be happy." See? In the Theravada tradition, that's how they end everything. They say, "And may all beings be happy." So the highest wish is that all beings should be happy. So there's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy. It's absolutely good to want to be happy. But sometimes to be happy, we kind of have to be simple. And to be simple, we have to do some work. You know, so basically, when you come to Sesshin, you know, the goal is happiness. And I encourage people in this. I say, "How is your sit?" And if somebody says, "Wonderful," "Ah, great," you know, I'm saying, you know, let's be happy. But on the other hand, sometimes you have to go through the shadow to get to that place, you know, or generally speaking, you have to go. So around day two, sometimes, the voice of the shadow can be heard, you know. And it can take different forms. Has many different forms, you know, basically. It can be, "You're no good," you know, I'm no good. I knew this Zen would never turn out. I knew this was just a bunch of crap. I knew that I could never do this. You know, enlightenment, that's not for me. You know, "You're a bad animal. I'm a bad person. I'll never, you know, be happy. Happiness is not my fate in life," blah, blah, blah. You know, there's many, many different shadows, you know. And yet, you know, Buddhism is based on the idea that even though we close the door in order to be happy, closing the door doesn't really make us that happy. In the long run, we need to open the door and look and see what's in there. And, you know, it's not necessarily a giant monster. It might just be a little monster, you know. So you open the door and it's not this terrible, terrible trauma. It's just something, you know, who knows? It's just, there was a person in our Zen group when I was training with Genki Roshi, who gradually discovered that he was gay, you know, and he had been keeping this hidden from himself for a long time. I don't know if this is really a shadow, but the shadow was that he had a hard time approving of himself. You know, he had a really hard time accepting himself. And part of his shame, his chronic guilt and shame, was that he had these feelings about men, you know. And I think he went through this long, tortured process of finally admitting he was gay. And then, you know, after a while, he was fine with it. You know, actually, he was like a super competent guy. He was an IT person, and I think he's had a really nice life, you know. But it was, at the time, it must have just felt like the most terrifying thing in the world to open that door and realize that he was gay. It was just like terrifying, right? I think it, you know, there must have been a lot of tears and shaking and terror. And, you know, and so on. And then, you know, it's like, "Oh, I'm gay. Okay," you know. So at some point, it became all right. You know, so I think there's all kinds of shadows like this, you know, you might want to be a novelist, right? And you want to be the greatest novelist that ever lived. And, you know, maybe your novel gets rejected from the publisher, you know, and you think you're going to commit suicide. "I think I have to commit suicide now. You know, this is so terrible. I spent 6 years writing this book and it's been rejected, you know, and my life is crap. I'm nobody. I'm nothing, you know." And that's a shadow state, you know. And why did you think you had to write a book in order to be worthy of breathing the air? You know, why did you think you needed to write War and Peace in order to deserve happiness? You know. After a lot of work, you might realize, well, I didn't write War and Peace, but you know, lots of people didn't write War and Peace. They seem happy. They're able to live their lives, you know, somehow and be happy, you know. So only Tolstoy could write War and Peace anyway, you know. So, and he, by the way, wasn't particularly happy, you know. And made many people around him profoundly unhappy, you know. So basically, opening the door is difficult, but it's not necessarily the case that there's a terrible monster waiting for us, you know. But Zen is all about opening the door, you know. When you are in day two of the Sesshin, you often encounter your shadow self, which is this powerful negativity, this powerful negativity, right? And it can take many different forms, right? Sometimes people have physical problems, you know, they have illnesses that are never going to be done with, you know. A friend of mine, a guy I used to work with, I just learned has AIDS now. He was gay, and his partner was a Brazilian man who had HIV, and now I guess my friend has it also. And I'm sorry to hear that, because you know that's like incurable. So I'm sure that's going to take some work on his part to deal with the fact that he has this incurable disease. But there are other incurable diseases too, you know, that people have. I could go on and on about different problems. You know, some people have chronic pain, right? They just have chronic pain. It's never going to go away, you know. Some people have I have a friend of mine who has Crohn's disease, which is this very horrible disease where you get these ulcers in your digestive system, and it can require surgery, and it's very crippling, you know. And you know, that's a real shadow cast over your life, right? We might not have a problem of that severity, right? You know, but when we're in day two of Sesshin, or when we're struggling with a koan, we sometimes encounter our shadow, and you know, it's complicated because you know, what we want to have happen is, you know, I will work through my shadow, and then I will have no more shadow, or I will have no further shadows, right? But that too is unlikely to be the case. I'm sorry to tell you, but you know, when you come to Sesshin and you encounter your negativity, you can work through it, and then you might think, there, done. I'll never have another negative moment. You know, but you come to the next Sesshin, and there it is again. You know, it's a little bit like pain in your legs. You know, you might reach a point where you say, I'll never have pain again. You know. But actually, there it is again. You know, the shadow may never go away, you know, totally. You may have to confront your shadow every time you come to Sesshin. And I think this is really being an alert and aware person, to know your shadows, right? To know your shadows. These are my shadows. You know, as long as I'm in this body, I'm going to have these shadows. But then the question is, am I going to let my shadows destroy my life? Am I going to let my shadows dominate me, or am I going to try to enter the bigger self, have a bigger mind? See, this is really what it's all about. We may never be able to leave our shadows behind 100%, but are we going to let them basically lock us up forever? Or are we going to try to live beyond our shadows, even though we carry them with us? This is like very important, it seems to me. Is you know, I one person I have always admired is Franklin Roosevelt, the former president. And Roosevelt was a very rich person. He had an incredibly wonderful childhood. His family was loaded with money. They were very aristocratic. And he became a Secretary of the Navy, and he was a very good, talented administrator, and he was really an up-and-coming political figure in New York State, and people really thought Franklin Roosevelt was going to probably be governor and then president of the United States. And Roosevelt contracted polio, and it utterly destroyed his legs, you know. And most people thought that his political career was over. And indeed, most people would have thrown in the towel. They would have just said, I'm a quote-unquote a cripple. You know, I can't even walk across the room. Who's going to accept a leader like that? But the United States, and maybe in normal circumstances, you know, Roosevelt would have gotten nowhere. But the United States went through a major depression, and we were in a terrible situation. There were no competent leaders, and Roosevelt had already begun to respond to his injury. You know, his terrible polio, and he, in spite of having polio, he learned to walk with braces. You know, he had these big, heavy braces, and he'd have these things he would strap to his arm, and he could walk to a podium, and people sometimes would carry him to the podium, and he'd put on these braces, and so he could stand up and give speeches, and he inspired millions of people and really saved the United States from maybe a terrible like fascism or something. Because I think he had suffered, he understood what it was like to suffer. And so he was very, very compassionate. You know, he was a very, very compassionate person with great empathy because he had suffered. But the interesting thing was that Roosevelt didn't let it destroy his life. You know, he didn't let polio become his destiny. You know, I read this book that was so interesting where this historian was... Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill were staying together at this place before this conference. And Roosevelt was walking down the hallway, and he saw, Churchill was walking down the hallway, and he walked by Roosevelt's room, and he saw Roosevelt trying to lift himself out of his wheelchair and get into a regular chair. And Roosevelt was trying to lift himself up and transfer himself over the chair, and he kept failing. He kept falling back into the wheelchair. But he wouldn't quit. You know, he kept lifting himself up and trying to get back in. And Churchill saw this and said, God damn it, you know, what an indomitable spirit. You know, he said, I want to be that man's friend, you know. And he said, I loved Roosevelt. And, you know, who wouldn't love a person who has that kind of indomitable spirit, you know? Roosevelt didn't let his injury, his shadow, destroy his life, govern his life. You know, we all have a shadow. We all have a shadow. But the question is, will it destroy us? Will it bind us? Or will we lead a more creative and open life? You know, I have a friend of mine who has an anxiety disorder. And basically this person I know has allowed the anxiety disorder to close her in all her life. And basically it's like, this person has avoided stressful situations, stressful experiences, potentially risky or dangerous experiences, new friends, and the person is now in her 60s, and it's like life has gone by without, it's like life is over, basically, almost for this person, and they have had like no life, you know, and the person has allowed, I would say, her anxiety disorder to destroy her life. I mean, I wouldn't say this to her, but But it's like, if you back away from things that cause anxiety, you'll never do anything in life, right? You won't get married, you won't have friendships, you won't try challenging jobs, you know. And indeed, this is sort of like how this person has lived, right? It's just like trying to stay away from the shadow. But it's so impoverishing, you know. And the person's a wonderful person. I'm not putting this person down. I'm not, I care very much about this person. But basically, you know, it's that's such a sad thing, right? That we need to, we all have a shadow. When we say we have no shadow, we're not telling the truth. When we come to Zen, sometimes we encounter our shadow. And then the question is, are we going to let the shadow, you know, dominate our lives? Or are we going to find ways to be creative and open, in spite, work through it, and be open and creative and alive, even though we have a shadow? So please don't think that life is about having no shadow. You know, that's the goal, because it's unlikely to be the case. Even the Dalai Lama has a terrible shadow, you know. I mean, he knows so many people who were killed, murdered. You know, his country was taken over by foreign invaders. That's a big shadow. You know, how do you have trust in life when your country has been so horribly and unjustly treated, you know? So he has a big shadow. I'm sure he has personal shadows too, but he hasn't. Look at the magnificent life he's led. You know, he hasn't let it destroy him as a human being. He's courageously dealt with his shadow. Umon said to his disciples, "Medicine and sickness cure each other." See, I mean, there's the light and the dark in us, right? We have the light and we have the dark. And actually, you know, if we didn't have a shadow, enlightenment wouldn't even be possible. You know, I mean, I have known a number of people who have had the Great Awakening experience, and I can't think of anybody who hasn't had quite a significant shadow to deal with, you know. And probably it took a big shadow to produce that kind of opening. So basically, you know, medicine and sickness cure each other. You know, there's the light and the dark. And you can't get to the light without going through the dark. You know, and maybe you can't even have the light without the dark. But, you know, the real question, and it's a question that comes up every moment on the cushion, is how you're going to respond to your shadow. Are you going to let it dominate you, or are you going to have the courage to live a bigger life. And, you know, you always have it seems to me that, like, you have to make a habit of not being stymied by your shadow. The shadow paralyzes us and it stymies us. You know, but if you start backing away from the shadow, you know, it just becomes more and more powerful. You have to just, you know, knock the chip off its shoulder. You know, you have to just go. You have to go for it. You have to challenge the shadow, and that in Zen terms, that means not, you know, giving way to hopelessness and despair, but you know, sitting on the cushion, entering deep mushin, you feel that sense of connectedness. You know, day two, you think that's it. You know, I can't do this anymore. I'm defeated. You know, and you go to bed and you get up in the morning, you come back to your cushion, you know, on day three, and you think, well, I'll give it another try, you know. And this is trusting the process, right? And you sit back down on the cushion, and all of a sudden you might have a sit where you feel absolutely magnificent, or at least you feel less bad, you know. So there's hope, right? You know, this is hopeful. Your darkest moment is not, nothing is permanent. Nothing is permanent. And if you keep practicing, you're going to find that there's this moment where you are liberated. You know, you are liberated. And you will have a bigger self if you don't let the shadow overwhelm you. You know? Umon said to his disciples, "Medicine and sickness cure each other. All the earth is medicine. Where do you find yourself?" All the earth is medicine. Ancient and modern, men make a great mistake. Shut the gate. Do not build the cart. That's what they think. Right? The universe is a highway, vast and wide. Mistaken. All are mistaken. We all have a shadow. Right? And though their noses are stuck up to heaven, they will all be pierced for a rope. You know, we're all in the same boat. You know, I mean, the Dalai Lama often says all people are the same. And people might not appreciate what that means, but we all have dark and light. You know, if you think the person next to you doesn't have to struggle with the dark, then you're kidding yourself. What makes exceptional people like the Dalai Lama is their courage in dealing with the shadow. Their willing, their openness, trust, trust. Trust doesn't take place in the absence of shadow. It is your response to the shadow.